The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's July 6, 2026 edition. This has two covers. Let's see if it has two back covers as well. Yes, it does. It has two back covers as well, so double the advertising there. The first front cover, well, both front covers, as usual, are bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. And then the one, the first cover says American Icons, created by Ralph Lauren, advertisement in collaboration with Ralph Lauren. There is a an image on the front that's very flag-like. It appears to be a blue denim background. And then there's a little white embroidered bit. Actually, it may be either woven or knit. But it's a white border around a little flag. Now, let's see. 2, 4, 6. The little flag has 6 horizontal white stripes and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 horizontal red stripes. Again, this looks either embroidered or knit to me. And then in the corner, in the upper left-hand corners, there's the little blue field, and it contains 13 little stars. Okay, that's the first front cover. Then the second front cover contains the date of the magazine, July 6, 2026. Same red, white, and blue motif, and it says in white lettering, Our America, in large white capital lettering, block lettering, in white, it says Time. Now, it said that on the first front cover as well, but it was nearly hidden by the American Icons caption. So on the second front cover, it says Time in large white capital block lettering. And there's an image of the head and shoulders of Lady Liberty, but it's not really Lady Liberty's face. It's a more updated face, perhaps one would say more stylish. But Lady Liberty's in shades of blue and white, and then has some kind of a collar draped around her neck and shoulders in red, white, and blue starred motif. So we'll see what this issue holds with the Our America theme and Ralph Lauren advertisement. I'll start by reading the opening letter from the editor, which I seldom do, but this gives some background as to the design of this magazine and its covers. It's by Sam Jacobs, editor-in-chief, A Window on America. Now, there's a very small inset photo here of the Empire State Building lit up in red, white, and blue. It's against a very, very dark blue to black night sky. And the tallest tower is in blue. And then below that, what looks to me like yellow, but maybe they think it's white, and below that, red. And next to it, a bunch of striped-looking flags. So maybe the stripes indicate the lighting that comprises the flags. Okay. At the beginning of 2026, to kick off this year's celebration of the 250th birthday of the United States, we published a list of America's most iconic companies. Based on a national survey conducted with our research partner Statista, we ranked companies including Ford, Apple, the Walt Disney Company, and 247 more, not solely by their commercial success, but by the vital role they have played in shaping culture and society. Time belongs in that group. We regularly meet people for whom time has played a key role in their understanding of this nation. The aid worker in Rwanda who waited each week for time to be delivered by airplane. The entrepreneur who grew up in India reading her father's copy each week, followed by a compulsory dinner table conversation, as well as so many living across the U.S. for whom time has offered access to the broader country and beyond. It was our co-founder, Henry Luce, who named the 20th century the American century, and for 103 years now, time has been an essential part of the American character, a window for the world and for Americans, a view onto ourselves. In a recent piece for Time, historian James T. Kloppenberg writes about the individuals who gave birth to this country. They fought on behalf of ordinary citizens empowered, for the first time in modern history, to act on the idea that all authority in a democracy comes from and remains in the hands of the people. We know that the media then, as it must today, played an essential role in nurturing our democratic traditions. For the past several months, led by our managing editor, Lily Rothman, with editor David Walters, we've been asking experts to tell us about the art, innovations, and places that capture the essence of American life to them. Their answers are included in this special semi-quincentennial issue of Time. Apple's Tim Cook selected the iPhone, SpaceX's Gwynne Shotwell, the rocket, Ken Burns, the Lincoln Memorial, Ralph Lauren, the Empire State Building, Bill Ford, Michigan Central Station. Olympian Michaela Schifrin pays tribute to the Rockies. Climber Alex Honnold grabs hold of Yosemite. And authors including Ann Patchett, George Saunders, and Min Jin Lee choose the books that define America. A few things stand out: the impact of technology on civic life, the hope inspired by the recent Artemis II mission, and above all, the belief that even at difficult moments, perhaps especially then, the American ideal in its many meanings endures and is worth celebrating. And for our food contributors, so does chicken in its many formats. The package was designed by Victor Williams with Jennifer Panzer, and photography was selected by Kim Bubello. Creative director D.W. Pine worked with artist Shepard Fairey to create his fourth cover for Time, this one channeling the Statue of Liberty and incorporating imagery from across history, including achievements in science, the arts, and industry. Time, of course, has covered America's anniversaries before. Our bicentennial special, written as if it were published in 1776, took a history-focused look at the founding. In 1926, we wrote about President Calvin Coolidge's visit to Philadelphia for the 150th. I love the idea of someone picking up this issue 100 years from now in search of America, knowing time can help them find it. Again, that was written by Sam Jacobs, editor-in-chief, and it was slightly abridged. Here is Conversation, Our America, behind the cover. Now, this person's referring to the second cover with the Statue of Liberty characterization. It's written by D.W. Pine. For a fitting cover to mark the 250th birthday of the United States, we turned the canvas over to renowned American muralist and graphic artist Shepard Fairey. That's spelled F-A-I-R-E-Y. Utilizing his distinctive graphic style, Ferry created a modern-day Lady Liberty, adorned with iconography of America's past. I wanted to reinterpret the Statue of Liberty because it is iconic and has wide appeal, making it a powerful and universal symbol, says Ferry, a native of Charleston, South Carolina, who's best known for his iconic 2008 Hope poster depicting then-presidential candidate Barack Obama. I think there are several aspects of its symbolism and history that are worth focusing on. The statue, after all, has a long history as a bearer of symbols, layers of them. When she was gifted to the U.S. from France, on the occasion of the U.S. centennial, fittingly for today, she celebrated the emancipation of the enslaved. Later, she became, in Emma Lazarus's words, the mother of exiles, one of the world's most recognizable icons of immigration, and the hope for a brighter future that has long drawn the world to these shores. Now in Ferry's hands, the Statue of Liberty is draped in a wide range of movements, moments, and ideas, calling out touch points and milestones from the past 250 years of American history, from the civil rights movement and jazz to the space program and the automobile. The cover marks Time's fourth collaboration with Ferry, who created two for Person of the Year, Barack Obama in 2008 and The Protester in 2011. More recently, his work graced the cover of Time's 2020 election issue. Ferry, a graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design, who began his career designing skateboards and t-shirts in the 1980s, says he's held on to the street art skate punk commitment to bending the rules in the name of what you believe in, even as he has come to believe that conversation can be more powerful than confrontation. Art is a beautiful tool to stir the imagination around big ideas and the meaning of life, but general ideas and feelings are just a starting point, he says. I would like to see more art and other media that reminds us how much we have in common and that we benefit from the society we're all part of, rather than stoking fear, division, and scapegoating. We are all in this together. And that was slightly abbreviated. Now to the brief section. Fragile Peace by Olivia Ann Cleary and Callum Sutherland. Even as the U.S. and Iran agreed to a ceasefire, President Trump underlined the chance it may not last. There's a photo here with President Trump front and center at a podium. The podium displays the insignia of the United States with the eagle and the flag shield. Behind Mr. Trump, there are flags. The only one I recognize is the stars and stripes. The other two are somewhat obscured and not recognizable to me. Trump is flanked on both sides by four men, two on each side, at least in this photograph. All are wearing dark-colored blue to very dark blue to black suits, white shirts, and a silver, three blue, and one red tie. G7 is on the wall behind the men. France, Evian, 2026. One page, here we go. Written again by Olivia Ann Cleary and Callum Sutherland. Just days after announcing the U.S. and Iran had agreed to a framework for a ceasefire, President Donald Trump threatened to restart the war. The agreement secures an extendable 60-day pause in fighting to allow time for further negotiations. But at a meeting of G7 leaders in France, June 17, Trump said if Iran does not fulfill commitments laid out in a 14-point memorandum of understanding, the U.S. will go back to bombing. I don't want to do that, he added, because the deal's so good. But we might have to because we're never going to let them have a nuclear weapon. The quick pivot from celebration to threat, even before the deal was officially signed, highlighted the precarious nature of what Trump called a historic agreement. He said Tehran had so far been acting very appropriately and praised the good negotiators who led the Iranian delegation. But his threat appeared to test the first point in the memorandum, which obliges both sides to refrain from the threat or use of force against each other. The full text of the agreement, which the White House made public after Trump's closing G7 remarks, obligates Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz for 60 days. The conduit for as much as a quarter of the world's oil had been open until Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran February 28. At the G7 meeting, fellow leaders of the world's top economies celebrated Tehran's agreement to demine the passage within a month. In exchange, Iran will receive $300 billion from regional partners, Trump said, not the U.S., to repair bombing damage and waivers on oil export sanctions during the initial 60-day negotiating period, immediately adding $13 billion in revenue to the $14 billion it made on a waiver Trump granted in March. Beyond that, $327 billion windfall. The memo also calls for establishing a means for Iran to access up to $100 billion in assets frozen overseas, as well as an end to all other sanctions. But the memo links those last two potential gains to the fate of Iran's nuclear program. The document again enshrines Iran's long-standing promise not to develop or procure a nuclear weapon, but leaves open to negotiation how that will be guaranteed. Though in May 2025, Israeli and U.S. airstrikes devastated the country's nuclear facilities, the regime retains a stockpile of hundreds of pounds of highly enriched uranium. The memo states this cache will be placed under the supervision of inspectors with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as it was under the nuclear agreement Iran hashed out over 20 months with the Obama administration, an agreement Trump discarded in his first term, complaining the pact gave Iran access to $51.7 billion in payments and unfrozen assets. The ceasefire memorandum does not address Iran's missile arsenal, nor its support for proxy forces in Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and Gaza, to which Trump has repeatedly demanded an end. But Hamid Reza Azizi, a visiting fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, tells Time the agreement is less clear-cut than it may seem, and its ambiguous nature, he says, could create problems down the road, especially when non-compliance brings the possibility of bombs. There's a lot of points that are open to interpretation, and those can lead to misinterpretation and probably miscalculation, and the resumption of conflict one way or another, Azizi says. Azizi points to the agreement's ninth provision, which commits both sides to maintaining the status quo during negotiations. Iran would keep its nuclear program at current levels, while the U.S. would refrain from imposing new sanctions or deploying additional forces in the region. But the status quo actually can mean different things, Azizi says. Indeed, at the G7, Trump hinted the ambiguities extend beyond the text. We have an understanding of certain things without writing it. And if they don't honor that, we will probably go back to bombing them until they honor it, he said. He did not elaborate on what those certain things are. Then there is Lebanon. The memo states the U.S. and Iran would immediately terminate military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon. But Israel, which has been conducting bombing and land operations in the neighboring country, is not a party to the negotiations. Earlier at the G7, Trump aired his frustrations with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has ruled out any immediate withdrawal from its northern neighbor. Since Israel launched its latest assault there in March, at least 3,783 have been killed and 11,699 injured, according to the country's health ministry. I say you can do a little softer touch, Bibi, Trump said at the close of the summit, reflecting on conversations with Netanyahu. You don't have to knock down a building every time somebody walks into it that's from Hezbollah. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun is set to visit the White House in June, Trump noted. The country, he argued, is a very small piece of the puzzle, actually, but it still makes a lot of noise. Now it is as clear as it has ever been that every piece counts. Here's a photograph, about half a page in color. There's a fire that's not here either, in the U.S. Pale blue sky in the background. Middle ground, black smoke. Foreground, two-story brick buildings, townhouses stacked one against another. British Union Jack flag in the slight background. Fire on the ground, enveloping two automobiles. Unrest in Northern Ireland. Fire engulfs cars and houses in East Belfast, June 9, after anti-migrant protests turned into violent riots, reportedly targeting the homes of black residents. The rampage came a day after the arrest of a Sudanese man in a stabbing attack. In a statement, the victim's family said it did not want a terrible tragedy to be used to divide people or fuel hostility. And at the bottom of this page, the bulletin, Ukraine moves closer to joining the European Union, by Tiago Ventura. Ukraine is a step closer to joining the European Union after member states agreed to open the first negotiating cluster in accession talks. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the addition would help strengthen peace, security, and prosperity across Europe. Still, Ukraine faces a complex road ahead. Ukraine applied for EU membership shortly after Russia's full-scale invasion, and in June 2022 was granted candidate status. Accession requires unanimous approval from all 27 member states. One conspicuous obstacle, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, an ally of Russia, was removed in March. when he lost to the pro-European conservative Peter Magyar. Countries seeking membership to the bloc must demonstrate democratic stability, a functioning market economy, respect for minority rights, and capacity to implement EU law. The Commission says Ukraine has made strides toward those goals, but setbacks involving corruption scandals have concerned European officials. Negotiations are divided into six clusters, with the first covering democratic values and the rule of law. This first cluster, the fundamentals, is basically horizontal. It pervades on all other issues, says Frank Schimmelfennig, a professor of European politics at ETH Zurich. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is eager to join the EU by 2027, though many view that timeline skeptically. Member states must unanimously approve each stage of the accession process, creating great potential for delays. Once all clusters are completed, the Commission drafts an accession treaty to be approved by EU institutions, member states, and the candidate country. Schimmelfennig said 2030 is often seen in Brussels as the magic date, but support for Ukraine's bid varies across Europe, meaning the country faces a lengthy process with no guaranteed timeline. The brief news. Good question. Why does watching sports make people happy? By Veronique Greenwood. There's a small inset photo here, apparently of a stadium filled with sports fans. The people in the front row are all wearing blue shirts. Some are wearing blue jeans. Others are wearing white pants. Many of them have their arms raised as if in shouts of hurrah. Some years ago, Helen Keyes was pushing her way through a World Cup crowd with her soccer-loving brother and father. "What is it about this sport or this event that you like?" she remembers asking them. "Is it the sport itself? Is it being around the other people? The sense of togetherness?" They had never thought about it. "I thought I would really like to think about it," remembers Keyes, who's a cognitive psychologist at Anglia Ruskin University in England. Keyes is one of many psychologists who view the World Cup, which is held every 4 years, as part of the quest to answer this question. What do people get out of watching sports? Their research has revealed that watching sports of all kinds, both in person and on a screen, can have positive impacts on well-being. And even when the home team loses, as they are practically guaranteed to do at some point, fans still derive benefits from the social act of following them. Using data from a survey of more than 7,000 people in the UK, Keyes and her colleagues set out in 2023 to see whether attending a live sporting event in the past year changed people's self-reported anxiety, loneliness, and sense that life was worth living, among other measures. The games did not have to be high-priced events with professional players. Local matches between amateurs counted too. What they found was that going to a live match significantly boosted some measures of well-being. Attending a live sporting event was associated with a greater sense that your life is worthwhile, Keyes said. Life satisfaction went up and loneliness diminished. A 2020 study by another group found watching sports on TV also positively affected life satisfaction and well-being. but it did not reduce loneliness the way being there in person does, says Keyes. Attending a live event, they found, had an even greater impact on people's sense that life was worth living than whether they had a job or not. Still, anyone who's felt the incredible highs and terrible lows of following a sports match must wonder, is this really a net benefit? They know going in, there's a 50% chance when they're finished consuming this product, they're going to be cranky, says Daniel Wan, a social psychologist at Murray State University in Kentucky, who has studied sports fandom for decades. The question has inspired a lot of psychological research, including on the phenomena of quirfing and berging, acronyms for cutting off reflected failure or distancing oneself from a team when they lose and basking in reflected glory when they win. But overall, sports fandom seems to be a win for mental health. I do not know how you can be a sports fan and not be resilient, Juan says. And in general, the psychological benefits of following a team are substantial. Individuals that are really involved in a sports team, they have higher self-esteem. They have lower levels of loneliness and alienation. They have a higher sense of social connectivity, he says. Fandom has the capacity to help individuals meet basic psychological needs, like the need to belong. At the same time, sports fandom allows people to set themselves apart from the group, giving themselves a unique identity within the community. You might be the sports fan who follows both football and archery, for example. Individuation is a basic psychological need, too. The regular cycles of sports also provide a kind of structure to fans' lives. Someone might remember where they were during the previous World Cup, or they might be planning their Super Bowl parties a full year ahead of time. These rituals are comforting, says Juan, and give people something to look forward to. As the World Cup unfolds, fans on every continent will congregate wherever they can cheer on their teams together. I'm sure there are a lot of psychologists in that group, Keyes says, asking all of those fans what's making this special for them about being with each other. Here is the brief milestones page. There are two articles. The first is Minted, the first trillionaire, Elon Musk, even richer. Jeffrey Kluger wrote this. A crowd formed outside the NASDAQ building in New York City's Times Square before the market opened June 12. Some were dressed as astronauts. Others wore T-shirts reading, Occupy Mars, a slogan made popular by SpaceX CEO and founder Elon Musk. The gathering was in the run-up to the company's initial public offering, which was expected to move 555 million shares of SpaceX stock. After the market opened at 9:30 a.m., the IPO exceeded expectations. SpaceX set the stock's opening share price at $135. At 1 p.m., it was trading near $170, pushing the company's valuation close to $2.2 trillion and putting Musk's worth at $1.1 trillion. That's a lot of treasure for a company that lost $4.9 billion last year and is net negative to the tune of $41.3 billion since its 2002 founding. But SpaceX has big wins in its portfolio, too. Its affordable and reusable Falcon 9 rocket has flown 649 times since an initial launch in 2010. With 165 flights just last year, representing nearly 51% of all launches by all companies or countries in that window. Its Starlink internet constellation has boomed to more than 10,000 satellites, with a goal of doubling that flock when a new bigger rocket dubbed Starship, with a massive cargo capacity, starts flying reliably. And NASA's counting on the upper stage of the Starship to serve as the crewed, that's C-R-E-W-E-D, lunar landing craft in the space agency's Artemis IV mission in 2028, a schedule that leaves little time for SpaceX to get the bugs in the booster worked out. But the company's biggest bet may be on setting up data centers which run hot in the ultra cold of space. All that gives SpaceX the opportunity to prove that its boss's head-spinning wealth is justified. But critics argue the mere existence of a man with more than $1 trillion in his pockets in a world of extreme wealth inequality is, at the very least, unseemly. Elon Musk, a trillionaire, pays the same amount into Social Security as someone making $184,500, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' point posted on the Musk-owned X. If we end that absurdity, we can make Social Security solvent for 75 years and expand benefits by $2,400. America's views on extreme wealth have long toggled between admiration and resentment. Musk has just become fabulously richer, as has his fabulously huge company. Now let us see if they are both worth the money. Chosen Artemis III crew, It's Their Mission, by Chantel Lee. Almost exactly 2 months after the successful splashdown of the Artemis II, NASA took the next small step in the quest to return to the moon when the agency revealed June 9 the four astronauts who will make up the crew of the Artemis III mission, set to take place in 2027. Commander Randy Breznik, pilot Luca Parmitano, mission specialist Andre Douglas, mission specialist Frank Rubio. Three of the men are American and one Italian. Jeremy Parsons, the acting assistant deputy associate administrator to the Moon, to Mars program office at NASA, said the mission will last about 2 weeks. It will not involve the crew landing on the moon. Rather, it will test one or two lunar landers in Earth orbit. This mission, said Parsons, is deliberately designed to take calculated risk so future crews will be safer and ultimately successful when we put boots on the lunar surface, which NASA plans to do in 2028. Now to the smaller column with four headings and five entries. Hospitalized, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, June 14, his spokesperson said, without sharing further details about why the 84-year-old former majority leader from Kentucky had been admitted, agreed that Fox Corp will purchase the U.S.'s largest streaming platform for smart TVs, Roku, the company said on June 15. The deal is valued at about $22 billion. Announced, a ban for kids under the age of 16 in the UK from accessing social media platforms like Snapchat and TikTok, Prime Minister Keir Starmer said June 15. The UK joins a growing list of nations that are considering or enacting age-based restrictions for certain apps. Died British actor Anthony Head, who played the role of Rupert Giles in the hit supernatural TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, at 72, his family said in a statement June 5. Also died David Hockney, the British artist known for vibrant portraits and scenes of Los Angeles, who continued painting until nearly the end of his life, June 11. He was 88. From Time Off, this is Movies, written by Stephanie Zakarik. High fashion drama wrought in small moments. Movies built from intertwining stories can be hard to pull off. Sometimes you end up caring more about minor characters than major ones, but isn't that a little like life anyway? French writer-director Alice Winocur's Paris set drama Couture takes place in the world of high fashion, though Winocur focuses less on the surface glamour than on the stresses and anxieties simmering behind the scenes. Couture is about the people who make the dream of fashion a reality. For them, it's not just diversionary artifice, but the bread and butter of their lives. Couture's central figure is Angelina Jolie's Maxine Walker, a filmmaker specializing in low-budget horror. A revered designer has brought her to Paris to make a werewolf-themed short to be shown at the start of his next show. This is not the sort of thing Maxine is used to doing. Though she looks elegant, even in her droopy travel clothes, she is still a woman of great practicality. But her marriage is breaking up. She has a teenage daughter who seems unreachable, and she simply needs to make money. She's ready to work with a good French cinematographer, Louis Jaurel, already lined up. Then she gets a call from her doctor. Some tests she had undergone before leaving home reveal she has breast cancer. Maxine, in denial, asks him if she can just deal with it when she gets home. He tells her the situation is urgent. She scrambles to deal with this new reality while finishing the challenging enough job at hand. Jolie is a formidable actor, and she makes you believe both in Maxine's initial disbelief and, a little later, in her worrying sense of urgency. But even though Jolie's Maxine has main character energy to spare, she is not necessarily the most compelling figure here. Winocur, a smart, sensitive director, made one of the most striking films of 2022, Revoir Paris, featuring Virginie Efira as a woman struggling with trauma after surviving a Paris terrorist attack. In that movie, as in this one, Winocur displays a gift for sculpting small moments. She may be better at them than she is at shaping big, revelatory ones. And so, it is the minor characters of Couture that we may end up caring most about. There's Ada, played with beguiling fortitude by Anir Ane, an aspiring model who arrives in Paris from South Sudan. She's to star in Maxine's pre-show movie. She's also being designated as the model who will open the show, a terrifying prospect considering that despite her innate elegance, she does not think of herself as a model at all. She's an outsider looking in. Our personal guide to this weird, unwelcoming world. Even more affecting is the story thread involving makeup artist Angèle, Ella Rumpf, who, feeling stifled by the shallowness of the world she's working in, aspires to become a writer. She recounts her daily experiences in a notebook, which she hopes to shape into a published work. In one scene, we learn she has hired a writing coach to help her mold these reflections into something sellable. In the video call she makes to him, we see a rumpled older man peering at her dismissively, telling her that although her experiences may be real, they're just not interesting. Then, in a stinging capper, he reminds her how she can remit payment. The power of couture lies in Winokur's gift for layering these types of details. As part of her job, Angèle needs to daub makeup on the model's feet, blistered from the torturous heels they are forced to wear. They wince when she does this, and you cannot miss the flicker of empathy that crosses her face. How dare any so-called writing coach tell her she's unfit to be a writer? Couture is filled with moments like these, small observations that may at first seem inconsequential, yet in the end, they are what makes a movie feel whole. Eliana Doctorman writes 9 questions. Let me count them. Yep, 9 questions on this page. Greta Lee, the actor on starring in Toy Story 5 as a tablet, navigating tech with her own kids and the decision to get a landline. Question and answer format here. Question, what made you want to play the tablet lily pad? Answer, I got a message from director Andrew Stanton, and Toy Story is one of those cultural phenomena I've loved for so long. I immediately said yes, then they sent the mock-up of the character image, and I began to panic a little bit. Why? Answer, Lily being a device made me realize they were going to go there in terms of the conversation around tech. I am a parent, and I am having those conversations. There was no way it was going to be chill. It was the first time I understood the responsibility and the risk. Question, how did you feel about that as a parent? Answer, I'm no parenting expert. I've been on my own journey of constantly trying to recenter my family's priorities. I recognize the parents in this movie. Nobody buys an educational tablet thinking, well, my child's never going to speak to me again. Sometimes it even feels like a social responsibility. I need to arm my kid to live in a tech-first world, especially for girls with STEM. It gets all wrapped up in this messy web. I'm so glad the movie does not back away from that. Question, do you have a policy at home? Answer, it is shifting. We've had to walk back iMessaging cousins and friends to organize a lemonade stand because we realized how quickly it creeps into screens all the time. The latest thing we got is a landline phone. How has that been? Question. Answer, it's been such a game changer. It's like a dam. There's no way they're going to live in a world without cell phones, but we're delaying it. I recommend people put a landline in a public space. The thing we griped about is kids. Having your mom intercept your call has been instrumental. You get a sense of who's your kid talking to? What's their community? Our boys were 9 and 7, and it was hilarious. We had to teach them to say hello when they picked up a phone. Otherwise, it was just a lot of standing there in silence or saying, are you still there? But now they talk to their friends all afternoon. Question, as you limit screen time for your kids, are you conscious of your own phone usage? Answer, With my first, I cannot believe the phone barrier I had between us. I wanted to document everything. One of my favorite parts of the movie is when the toys go on the roof and see nobody's playing outside. It looks dystopian because every person is inside with a screen in front of them. Question, they need to get outside. I read you keep chickens. Answer, we have, but we live in a place in Los Angeles where there are lots of predators, so our current chicken count is zero. We're not in full donkey or pig territory, but we're cuspy. Question, obviously Disney, which is behind this Pixar movie, has a streaming service. How do you reconcile a streaming company weighing in on tablet use? Answer, I have heard Andrew Stanton say there's no contest between tech and toys. It's already over. For me, it's so actory, but I'm just trying to humanize a tablet. Lilypad is super focused on making Bonnie friends through messaging and games on the tablet. And that's exactly what the doll Jessie wants, too. So instead of the binary question of whether streaming, tech, and AI are good or bad, I mean they're bad, but as parents we know the conversation does not end there, it was more about being deliberate about how do you foster real friendship. It is not necessarily through messaging or games. And finally, question, you are famous for your red carpet looks. Do you worry about kids' sticky hands on your clothes? Answer, at home I'm in jorts, J-O-R-T-S. I maybe shouldn't admit this, but my kids have also tried everything I've worn. I have a whole camera roll of them wearing all of these sculptural pieces or this leather armor I wore. It really is a gag. Again, written by Eliana Dockerman, Greta Lee, the subject. I'm pulling a page out of Time's Our America 250 list of important things, I guess I'll say. This one is art and design. There's a photo here of Rosie the Riveter by Norman Rockwell. Rosie captures something enduring about the American spirit, a woman strong enough to keep a nation moving, confident enough to know her own power, rooted enough to fight for something larger than herself. Rockwell also understood American strength was never individual. It's the strength of a people united around a common cause. The challenges facing American mothers today demand the same grit Rosie embodied. And that caption was written by Olivia Walton, board chair of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. Okay, this was a cover of Saturday Evening Post. It's not, the date is not given. But it's Rosie the Riveter, and she's sitting on like a metal beam, a steel beam. She's sitting on the small end of it in front of a flag. It's kind of a drapey-looking flag. The stars are up in the left-hand corner, and the stripes are floating along behind Rosie. Rosie looks like a sizable individual. She's wearing denim, a denim short-sleeved shirt. She has huge muscles, denim pants rolled up at the cuff. She's wearing penny loafers, brown penny loafers, and she's wearing red socks. That may be part of the Rockwell USA red, white, and blue motif. On her lap, because she is seated, is this huge contraption. I guess it's a riveter. It's a long device, a couple feet long, looks pretty heavy to me. It looks like a huge hammer, I guess you'd say, except at the end where you would hold the handle, it's got a curve like a cane and is attached to a really kind of crummy and frayed looking hose. And so I'm guessing that out of the other end of this, well, let's call it a pastry tube, are the rivets. Anyway, she's got a wrist support. I used to see men hay baling, throwing the bales, and they would wear these wrist supports to help stabilize their wrist in the heavy work. She has a sandwich in her left hand. She has goggles pushed up onto her forehead. She's looking down. She's looking askance from the camera or the artist. She has very vivid red hair. And I think she has the goggles. She may also have a headset. It's very difficult to see because it kind of fades into the red hair. She's wearing lots of buttons on the top of her shirt. The shirt's open at the collar. Top of her shirt. One is a red cross. The other has a V. I'm guessing maybe it's a V for victory. Another one or two have red, white, and blue motifs. Two look like pennies. Maybe there's some kind of award medallions or something. And then there's a larger, rounder button that might be her ID badge. There's no legible writing, but there's a face on it. And so that is Rosie the Riveter by Norman Rockwell. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number, again, is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.